Hello, everyone, and welcome to this audio conference training for the Rural Grantees of the Office on Violence Against Women. Our topic today is Rural Barriers to Battered Women, Relevant, Realistic, and Sustainable Solutions. I'm Liz Carlson, and I'll be the host for today's call. Our session today is going to be operated in a little different way than what we usually do. Rose Thielen, our technical assistance partner and also former battered women's advocate, will be conducting this call much more like an interview than what we're used to. We're very fortunate to have three knowledgeable advocates with really extensive experience in addressing barriers to battered women with us today. Pat Dunleavy is an advocate at Range Women's Advocates in northern Minnesota. Virginia Perez Ortega is the Rural Project Coordinator at the New Mexico Coalition in Albuquerque. And Leticia Wilson is the Operations Director at the Center Against Rape and Domestic Violence in Corvallis, Oregon. So I'd like to welcome all four of you today.
Thank you. Thank you, Liz.
Hi. So, Rose, I am going to go ahead and turn the call over to you.
Thank you, Liz. Good afternoon, everybody. Thanks for joining our call. And I, too, am excited to welcome Pat, Virginia, and Leticia to this call because they have some programming that they'd like to speak about that uniquely meets the needs of their rural areas. And so I think it's going to be a learning experience for all of us and help all of us to think about how are ways that we can capitalize on our communities, the rural aspects of our communities to meet the rural needs of the women that we work with. And so I'm going to just my job is going to be primarily to say, okay, take it away and let them roll with the conversation about the project which they're going to speak about. And so I'm going to start with Pat, who's going to provide an overview of many of the things that Range Women Women's Advocates, which is a program in northern Minnesota, has done. But before we begin that, I wanted to ask each of you to describe a bit about how big is your program, whether it's a shelter or not, how big is your service area, and like how many people per square mile, just so you get a sense of who's speaking and it's a context for what they're speaking about when they talk about the specific programming. So let me begin with that. Pat, tell us a little bit about Range Women's Advocates in terms of its structure and its size and the scope of the community.
We're very rural. We're iron mining communities in very northern part of northeastern Minnesota. Our service area is roughly the size of Massachusetts. Population is about 85,000 and shrinking. Our program is about 32 years old and was started by a group of women who were very definitely feminists and who were thinking about how to deal with what was a silent problem in most communities and most families at the time. And they developed all of the services based on what battered women told them they needed most.
Okay. You know, Pat, before you get into the specifics of it, let's go around to Virginia and Leticia just to see about, you know, where they're calling from, size
sure.
of their program. You're not a shelter, right?
We're
You're
a community-based program. We have no shelter. We actually created the concept of safe homes.
Well, what do you have in terms of population per square mile? Do you know?
I don't know how that translates.
Okay.
I think you're
kind of considered what they call frontier, six people per square mile, but I'm not sure.
It's something like that.
Yeah, a big
like
vast wilderness up there, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Okay. So, Virginia, tell me a little bit about your program. Where are you? Are you a shelter? How big the service area?
In fact, we are a coalition, the New Mexico Coalition Against Domestic Violence. And this particular project that I'm going to be sharing with you all is it includes nine of our 30 member programs as partners of the coalition. So it varies by community. Some, New Mexico is a rural state, is ranking the number 5 of the 36th in population. So it's extremely rural. If anyone has been around here, It's beautiful, but it's really hard to find, cities or suburban areas. So I'll be sharing from the coalition perspective. Some of our programs are shelters. Some of the partnering agencies offer shelters. Some of them don't.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Leticia, how about you? What's it like out there in Oregon where you're working?
Well, we have two different counties that we serve, and we are a shelter program. But one of the counties that we serve is really big. There's about 110,000 people and a little over 2,000 square miles, so it's about 48 people per square mile. And then the other county that we serve is very different. It's about 86,000 people, and it houses one of the biggest universities in the state, but they don't count those people in the population. So it's about 120 people per square mile. So it's much smaller. It's about 679 square miles for that county, and we work in both of those counties.
Very good. Okay. So thanks. That gives us a bit of a sense of what you're talking about when you're speaking about rural. So now, Pat, why don't you launch into an overview of Range Women's Advocates? You mentioned something about coming from a very feminist, and I'm assuming grassroots, perspective. Do you want to just go with that then and talk about how you have met the needs in terms of overview over the years to serve your specifically rural population?
Mm-hmm. The women who created the program stayed with it for many, many years, and they had a strong desire to emulate shared decision-making. So when they started organizing, they did it very informally, and they listened to battered women to determine what to do to help them. And that is a common theme that has stayed throughout everything that we do. Right now it exists in all of our problem solving as advocates. None of us is expected to work solo, especially on the more difficult situations. We huddle on a regular basis if we've got something that is particularly hard or has something unique about it so that we can share ideas around a whole case. We also team up and do tandem advocacy on the more challenging and draining cases in order to prevent burnout and to give a higher level of service to especially women who are being stalked aggressively, women who have been strangled, women who are in prolonged battles in court over assets and children. We have a fourth generation European immigrant population overlaid on a Native American population. So we're dealing with people who came to this country seeking something different, and the women have always taken the lead on the Iron Range in anything involving social change. They're the ones who insisted that education be the finest it could be, and that carried over into the creation of the program and into the creation of new services as the program grew. One of the first things that happened was going out to where people live to work with them, because public transportation here has always been negligible. And as the economy changed, a few problems with individual car ownership, reliable cars, became increasingly a problem. So we go out to do a lot of advocacy. An example is Ely is an hour from where I live, and I might need to go up to Ely, take all the forms with me to do an order for protection, drive the victim to a local insurance agency or bank, get a notarized signature, take her back home, and then deliver the paperwork back to the courthouse. Increasingly, we're able to deliver the finished paperwork by fax or email, but that's only very, very recent. We also actually help people with transportation to the courthouse for hearings as needed. We have a few volunteer drivers who can assist us, and we get most of those from the retired population, people who have time, and we pay them mileage. Our intake, when we first sit down with someone who thinks they need our help, we have a very deliberately informal intake process, which is basically a conversation in which an advocate tries to establish rapport, talks about listening, asks the woman to talk about what's going on right now, what brought you to us right now, and dealing with her immediate needs, asking her to simply tell her story.
All right.
And by telling her story, we hear some of the things we need to start working on right away, and it creates a pathway. We also talk a lot about walking alongside women and letting them determine where they want to go. We may have a lot of ideas about what they could consider doing, but we don't want to repeat what a batterer is doing to them by imposing their decisions on them. We need to give them that right back. And how we do advocacy is very, very important because they've lost the knowledge in many cases that they have a right to make their own choices. We actually have a policy that a certain number of staff have to be advocates. I mean, a number of the advocates have to be survivors. And that's to make sure that the survivor voice is always present as we make operating decisions and as we carry out our work. Our bylaws prioritize having at least some survivors as members of the board of directors so that that voice is present in the creation of policy and in the oversight of the organization as a whole. When we evaluate staff, we call and talk to some of the women advocates have worked with to get a sense of how well they're doing what we want them to do. We also conduct focus groups on a regular basis so that as we got ready to create the children's program about 10 years ago, we talked with a lot of women with children and asked them what kind of help they needed most. And that formed the curriculum for the program. And I'll get into detail on that a little bit later. The last 2 years, we've been working diligently on our coordinated community response, looking particularly first at strangulation, then at stalking, then at repeated violations of orders for protection. And each of those topics, as we got ready to start on them, we would convene a focus group and we would encourage people to come by paying their mileage and offering a $25 gift card at a local department store that's very popular. And we had very good participation, a lot of good feedback. We recorded those conversations as well as took notes while we were in the meetings. And then we brought that, a summary of that information to the coordinated community response meeting so it would guide our conversations. And then as we develop approaches, we'll take it back to some of those women and ask questions about, is this going to be a problem? If it is, how? And what can we do to modify? But using the voices of women who have been there is a constant, and I think it's a strength of our program. It forces things to slow down a little bit at times, but I think it's really critical to stay focused on women and not on what we think they may want. When we talk with law enforcement, it helps them to hear the voices directly. So we'll bring stories, we'll bring actual women, if they're healthy enough and strong enough, to share their stories in person. It makes a huge difference, especially with law enforcement, to hear an actual victim talk about why listening is so important. The training we do with new on-call volunteers and with new staff is focused on this informal intake process and on always, always listening to women talk about what they want. And with the knowledge that in almost every case, women start out wanting to salvage the relationship. They remember what things were like when they were first dating. And we've all seen him apologize over and over and over and say it'll never happen again. And there's a lot of other cultural influences that make it difficult to leave, even if you want to. But we're not the ones making that decision. Women need to make that decision. We can give them suggestions. We can give them options. But we have to live with their decision, and so do they. So, Rose, that's about it for the moment. Did I miss something?
Let me ask you something. Now, you know, a lot of people, it's a value to include women in terms of the programming, and yet it can be difficult to actually keep women involved. I mean, do you have good involvement? I mean, and how do you do that?
In the last several years, it's been primarily through focus groups. At one point in time, we did have an ongoing advisory group, and that ran for about 3 or 4 years, and it just kind of petered out on us.
Mm-hmm.
And what we do is basically what's built into policy, what's built into job descriptions for all of us, and
mm-hmm.
it comes out of long-range planning committee, which looks at what part of the program do we need to look at in depth to see if it's doing what we want it to do, or are people asking for something new and something different, and let's do a focus group around that. And when I say focus group, that might turn out to be both a focus group where you've got them all in the same room and a series of individual interviews by telephone in order to reach the right mix of people, cover the jurisdiction, cover the demographics adequately.
Now, tell me, Pat, does this make a difference in terms of how the community views your program? I mean, the fact that you so centralize the women's voices, and you when you speak about it, you make them central. You don't position yourself, and your messaging is never about we're just going to help these poor women. It's always about the women are guide us, right?
I think in terms of community awareness, I don't think the community as a whole is anywhere near as aware of that as the women we work with. We talk with United Way, with community groups, we mention it, but we don't spend as much time talking about it. We talk about our services a little bit more. So I'm not sure that they're as aware of that. Now, there is, because this is a mining community and because it is still a relatively macho culture, we do get some backlash on our name because
mm-hmm.
we are range women's advocates. And we get a question from some people about, well, do you serve men? But that's a relatively small number of people.
Okay. All right. And we're going to be spending some more time with you after we talk to Virginia and Leticia about the specific program that we want to highlight from their area. So we'll get back to you, Pat. Thank you for that overview, and
mm-hmm.
look forward to hearing some more. So now I'm going to move. Let's move to Leticia. And after we talk to Leticia, we'll open up the line and give people an opportunity to ask questions. So Leticia, do you want to tell us something about your program, or does anything that Pat said trigger anything for you in your own thinking before you begin?
Yeah, I definitely think a lot of what we've done is very similar to what Pat has done, not necessarily the programs, but just a little bit about how our services started and how we still continue to operate our program today. So it's very similar.
Okay. And that would be the small grassroots kind of aspect coming out of the feminist movement, per se? Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Similar. And just listening to survivors' voices, making sure it's the best thing that we should be doing for survivors, and just making sure that they're represented on staff, on our board. It's a very similar approach.
Okay, very good. Okay, so tell us about the programming that you brought to our attention that you're doing that meets the needs of your rural population, and how it came about, and where it's at now, that kind of thing.
All right. Well, we started a program in our biggest rural county that we serve. In about 2005, we started developing a relationship with law enforcement and starting to get some policies down with other community partners in terms of a response to domestic violence. So we did get a rural grant then, which enabled us to be able to add some advocates to staff, and we really just changed how we provided services in the area. So we partnered with law enforcement. We have always had a relationship with law enforcement, but this was a program where law enforcement got some training. We did some training together about when they should call us and how they were going to call our hotline when they were making an arrest for domestic violence. And that was every time that they were making an arrest. So it's four law enforcement agencies that we were working with in the county. And they called us when they made an arrest, and our main goal was to respond on scene after, you know, the perpetrator was taken away, and we were to stay with the woman in her house, do some safety planning, and, of course, this was all if she wanted us to be there, do some safety planning and just help figure out what the next steps are going to be. So it involved a lot of partnerships with different agencies in the community. So we worked go ahead.
I was just going to ask you if it took a lot of extra staff then. I mean, are they called out frequently, that kind of thing?
Yeah, in this particular county, we have about 12 domestic violence arrests per week. And so with the grant, we were adding two extra staff so that we were able to respond. And we chose to respond 24/7 because we just never knew when it was going to be happening, when there was going to be an arrest made. You know, sometimes someone's going in to make a report to the police station and they're already left their home. So we just decided to be available all the time, and we're still actually available. So all of our advocates are trained to respond on scene, and then we have some advocates that are, you know, doing this more than others to be able to respond on scene. But law enforcement calls our 24-hour hotline to try and pass on the information. And then we just work from there to try and respond to the on scene. So the county is pretty big. A lot of it is national forest. So we don't actually respond in the whole county. We've had the sheriff's office kind of designate an area that's not safe where you lose cell phone receptions. So we brainstorm with other people how they can get to public places if it's not safe for us to respond in the whole county. But otherwise, we just, you know, drive. It could be anywhere from 30 minutes to about an hour from our administrative office to try and meet people where they're at, and really just expanded our services to see what they needed in the moment and really learned from battered women what's going to be the best for them. So it's included a lot of stuff. It's included transportation, gas vouchers, getting to court, trying to connect them with local resources in their area. Just like Pat said, our public transportation system in the rural area just isn't very accessible. The hours are limited. Where you can actually go is limited. So we have really worked with women to get them transportation back and forth, especially because this is linked to the criminal court. And so we want to make sure that people are able to get to court if they want to, or be able to go apply for a restraining order if that's what they need. So we help them with some of that transportation, which is definitely, you know, that is where we take up probably the most of our staff, is a lot of driving that we're taking up when, you know, we're driving to pick someone up. It might be an hour to get back to the court. So it definitely adds up over time. And we do work with some volunteers to be able to cover some of our other responsibilities at the agency when advocates might be out meeting with clients or doing some transportation.
Now, are the women told that you're coming and that they should wait for you, or how does that work when they're going to wait maybe an hour for you to get there?
Yeah, we actually speak to every battered woman on the phone before we come. So what happens is law enforcement calls us. We say, you know, are you done? Can we talk to the woman right then? And then we're able to talk to her, say, you know, this is totally normal for us to come to the house. If you want us to come over, we will. It's going to take about this amount of time, and just kind of see where they're at. They're definitely guiding what we're doing. And if they say they don't want to come, that's fine. But we have really tried to be more on top of meeting them where they're at when they want it. So if they're ready right then, it's, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning, it's going to take an hour, we're there. If they want it tomorrow at a different time, we're definitely there. And we take two different advocates, so sometimes that takes a little while too, but we found that it's definitely safer having two advocates going to the home together. So the battered woman definitely gets the choice, but we just try to expand our services to meet her needs.
And how receptive are the women to your visits or to your contacts? How many of them say, yes, come out here, and how many of them say, I'll meet you somewhere else, and how many of them say, I don't want to talk to you?
Yeah, I would definitely say that probably 25%, just guessing on kind of my experience, 25% are saying, that's great, come right now, I really need, you know, they might need a restraining order packet. They may need a 911 cell phone. They might just want some of the resources that we're able to give them. I would say probably maybe 50% say, oh, you know, I met an advocate earlier today, or I'm going to restraining orders tomorrow, and so we figure out another way to meet them, or meet them in public somewhere, because we definitely meet people in public places. And this is in their community, so if we met them in a public place, we wouldn't be asking them to come to where our office is. Unless they wanted to, we'd be going to wherever they're at. And then I would say probably about another 25% says, I don't want to have anything to do with you, don't call me. Because what we also do is we make follow-up calls. So if they don't want to talk to us right then, you know, they say, I don't want to talk to you, don't call me. We say, that's fine, we just get off the phone. But there may be other people that pass it on through law enforcement. So we just continue to check in. When they don't want any more contact, we stop contacting them. So I would say, you know, we probably reach about 75% of the people that are interacting with, and this is just specifically when law enforcement's making the referral to us.
Mm-hmm. Letitia, did you you mentioned that you find other places to meet? Does that mean that you have locales that are throughout the county that are you've got agreements with that you can meet a woman, or how does that work?
Absolutely. So, yeah, in the different towns that we have kind of designated some places, whether it's, you know, a local church that has maybe contacted us, or we've contacted them, or somehow developed a connection with them to meet at their location and be safe. Or we've also used a local community college, which has a Department of Human Services in it as well. So if someone's coming for their regular meeting, we have the rest of the college to try and meet in a separate place. We also work with other shelters or organizations that house just a general, like, homeless shelter. We also work with them in the different communities. So in each community, we've tried to develop a relationship with other agencies, other social service agencies or churches, to be able to find a space to meet, to get to know the staff, they get to know us. And sometimes we've actually even held office hours in the different locations so that we can tell people, we'll be in your community this day, this time, if you just want to stop in. Or we also schedule it one-on-one meetings in these different locations. But it's nice to have a place that we can say, you know, how do you feel about meeting at this church? Is this going to be safe? And then picking that location. So being more familiar with all the towns that we're going to. And there are some smaller towns where we, you know, there's only one general store, and we may have to get really creative where we're going to meet. But in that small of a town, it might not even be safe to meet in that community. So we just strategize with the battered woman about what's going to be the safest.
Oh, that sounds cool. Say, now, I want to ask you, were there aspects of the rural area that you feel enhanced your capacity to do this project? I mean, were there connections that you could, I want to say exploit, that's not the right word, that's kind of a negative spin on it, but did people know people who knew people who could get you into these places, or how did that work?
Yeah, I definitely think it was some people who knew people to get us in there, or it was different people outreaching to us and making referrals to us. So like the general homeless shelter wasn't taking in domestic violence victims, but they were referring them to us. So we made a connection in that sense. And then different places that would come up, you know, it was a lot of clients telling us where they were going, what church they were going. They really liked their church. And then we would be like, okay, well, let's check out this location. Let's get to know these people because, you know, the client likes it. And we, you know, that might be a safe place that we can meet. And it's also clients who have been a member of the church that have maybe, you know, said something to their pastor or said something to other people that are at the church, which then increase the awareness of domestic violence and people contacting us about, you know, if you need a support group location or you need to meet with somebody, we want to be involved or we want to donate to your organization. So it really was just kind of that word of mouth, how we established some of the places that we were going to meet with people.
Very good. And tell me about how you were able to set this up with the law enforcement agencies. You mentioned you work with, was it four of them?
Mm-hmm.
Four law enforcement agencies. Are they full-time law enforcement agencies, or are they part-time or small departments?
Yes.
were they open to this right away? Did you write them into the grant? How did that work? How did you get them to go along with this? Because I know in a lot of rural areas, people grapple with, oh, how do I get law enforcement on board?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely always been a struggle to get law enforcement involved in what we do. But the on-scene response was written into the grant, but there wasn't a lot of strategy in the beginning written into the grant about how it was actually going to work. And so we used the district attorney's office, who is also a paid partner on the grant, to be able to work with law enforcement with us so that it wasn't the advocates going straight to law enforcement, which is, you know, sometimes been a point of contention. But it was a district attorney going in and saying, I think this is really going to enhance what we do, and kind of being our ally through this. So when we met with law enforcement in the beginning stages of this, it was the district attorney's office always being there as that extra person and supporting both of our efforts. And then we worked with a kind of like one point person at each agency, because they are all full-time agencies. There's three different towns and then the county sheriff's office that we were working with. So we had one point person who was either a supervisor, a chief, or a sheriff that we worked with to develop a policy so that they knew what it was going to look like every time. And then we went to each law enforcement agency and spoke to them about, this is what it's going to look like when we come on scene. They were able to ask us questions and just be in a dialogue with us about how this was actually going to work, what we wanted from them, what they wanted from us, and try and work out some of the kinks or some of the problems that they foresaw during all of this. And it's been great. Over the last 5 years that we've been doing this, we've added more programs with law enforcement and just tried to be in daily contact with the people that are our point people to see, well, what did we miss overnight? Was there something that happened? But if everybody can hear the feedback. But we work with the district attorney's office to tell us, you know, who was arrested overnight or over the weekend. And then we follow up with point people at each law enforcement agency to try and make sure that everybody is following the process that we set up. And so it's worked quite well. I think there was a lot of resistance in the beginning because it was one extra thing that law enforcement had to do. But now they see it as, we're coming in, we're doing a lot of the safety planning, and that it's less time that they have to be on the call because they don't have to provide all the safety planning resource information, that we just come in and take over right when they leave.
Oh, sounds very good. So, Leticia, let's open the line now and see if there's any questions or comments, and we'll be getting back to you in the end as well. But thank you for that overview. And at the end, also, we'll be talking about resources that might be available for the people on the line. Okay, Liz, or I guess it isn't Liz at this point. It's we've got somebody else online to open it up, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Go ahead, Stephanie. Oh.
At this time, if you do have a question, please press the number 1 on your touch-tone phone at this time. Be sure to press the number 1 only once. If you press it more than once, you will remove yourself from the question queue. And just one moment, please.
Sure. And while Stephanie is waiting to see who is in that question and comment queue, just a quick little reminder, if you can, just give us your name when you sign on. Let us know where you're calling from so we can make those connections on the line. While Stephanie is waiting to see who is signing in, I had a question for you, Leticia. I wonder if I can just ask it quickly. I wondered what kind of feedback you've heard from the women that you're serving that are now benefiting from this kind of collaboration with your local law enforcement.
Yeah, it's definitely been all over the place, because I think there are definitely people that don't like being, you know, connected to resources, or they don't like to feel like everybody's interfering with their life. But I think the overwhelming positive feedback has been people getting connected to shelter immediately. We also work with them through the criminal process, and so it's just all these different steps that people walk through that we are accompanying them to and helping them kind of navigate and just keeping them safe through the whole process. Because if they don't come into shelter and they stay at their home, we still are contacting them about, you know, what's happening in the criminal trial, what are the proceedings, what do they need, how can we help them and give them support. So I think the initial connection to us for a battered woman who would have never worked with our services or never been provided support before has definitely been enhanced by the connection with law enforcement.
Okay, we actually do have a question in the queue at this time, and that comes from the Domestic and Sexual Violence Program. Your line is open.
Hi, this is Allison from Program in Red Lodge, Montana.
Hi, Allison.
Hi, Rose. How are you?
Good.
My question is for Leticia, and it's about safety considerations for your staff and advocates going into someone's home. I heard you say that the batter has been taken away, but in our cultural context, guns are very pervasive. Methamphetamines are very pervasive. We do not ever go into somebody's home, you know, because even though the batter has been taken away, you know, maybe his buddy hears that the woman's gotten him arrested. So what was your calculation in terms of making that decision to go into a potentially dangerous place?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think it's a good question. We definitely have the same issues with, you know, drugs and guns. And so what we do is we're talking to law enforcement before we're talking to the survivor on the phone. So law enforcement's giving us some basic information about the batterer, the victim, if there are kids in the home, kind of what the state is. And I think different law enforcement officers are giving us different amounts of information. But we ask some other questions about, you know, what's the situation like? Is there anybody else in the home? Are there children in the home? And then we also partner with law enforcement to do kind of a lethality screen with them out of the Maryland Network Against Domestic Violence model. And so it's telling us some of that information, which leads law enforcement to be thinking about what's the safety when we're going to be coming in. And, of course, they don't all think about it, but we ask our specific questions. And then we get connected to the survivor. We talk to them. We decide that we're going to be going to their house if they want it to. We're going to pass the phone back to have the survivor pass the phone back to law enforcement and tell the law enforcement officer, you know, we're going to be responding to the home. Is there anything else we should know? And so what we're asking them to do at that point is give us some more information if they think it's unsafe. And we've definitely been in homes before, which is why we go in pairs, where we don't necessarily think it's safe, or we just kind of get a feeling where we need to make this as fast as we can. But for us, we're going to be going into uncomfortable situations, and we just try to be as safe as we can as we're going into some of these situations, because what may be normal to someone else isn't normal for me. And so we just try to navigate it as safely as we can to make sure that we're safe as advocates and that we make the decision when we need to leave. So maybe we're there for 5 minutes, maybe we're there for 2 hours, but we're constantly monitoring what our safety level is, and law enforcement knows that we're at that home if someone is to show up, or if someone comes over, we definitely make sure, you know, the door is locked and we can call law enforcement as we needed to. And we've been very lucky as we've been doing this for 5 years, and we haven't been in a situation where someone has actually tried to get into the house or break into the house while we've been there.
And do you, you know, do you send your advocates in with a can of mace, anything like that?
We actually don't. We've never been in this situation where we have felt like someone's going to hurt us, because what we know is that they're not after me. So if someone's coming in, they're not going to be trying to hurt me, and they're probably not going to be trying to hurt this person, because someone, they're probably going to be upset about the situation, but someone was just taken to jail. And so I think that's showing the community, or if we're in an apartment complex at large, that law enforcement's definitely involved, and they can be angry and they can be mad about it, but they can't, I mean, they can't hurt me. And we don't have anything to try and protect ourselves, because I wouldn't want that can of mace turned around on me and used against me if I, you know, tried to use it on someone else.
And do you know, has it had any implications on your liability insurance?
No, it hasn't.
Do they know that you're going into people's homes? Because that's certainly something when we, you know, do our liability insurance, they want to know where we are physically.
Yep, yeah. They know that we're going into people's houses. They know we're driving our own cars, so...
Thank you, Allison, for the very good questions. I see that it's given the clock here. Is there any more in the queue? Otherwise, we'll just go on to Virginia.
At this time, there are no additional callers in the queue.
Oh, it's working out. Okay. Thank you for those questions, Allison, and your responses, Leticia. Now, Virginia is coming with a project that is completely different, and I think it really capitalizes uniquely on the aspects of the community that are in place. And so, Virginia, why don't you tell us something about what you're doing in the coalition in a number of rural communities?
Sure. Thank you for the opportunity to share this this project, innovative project, I believe. It is called the New Mexico Rural Promotora Project, and I'll go over what the Promotora stands for. And it's basically utilizing community members, already trusted community members, to preventing and addressing violence against women in all forms. And so one of the biggest needs that we saw here in New Mexico for that we still actually see is the need to mend the gaps between community and service providers. The population in New Mexico is very diverse. We have almost 50%, it's actually 45% of the population in New Mexico identified themselves as Hispanic, and within the Hispanic Latino there's a lot of subgroups, so it's totally diverse, and 90, and there is Pueblos, Native American Pueblos, and so the programs oftentimes struggle with victims of different ethnicities not seeking services. And the Coalition Against Domestic Violence, we have 30 programs, and 9 of them in very rural, operating in very rural areas. So we partnered with them to try to apply this this model that is basically gathering, recruiting promotoras, recruiting leaders that are already doing things in their community, that the community already goes to them, and not only for domestic violence, sexual assault, or violence-related issues, but for everything that they may need. And so promotoras are local community members. Like I said, they could be someone who engages in prevention of diabetes or educating on other health-related issues. It comes from a model based in Latin America in specific rural locations where underserved populations are engaged, mostly through peer education. You have to make sure that the community listens to you, and you have to do that coming from a professional, with a professional hat and maybe company car or government car. It's the community is feels threatened to the anything that you have to share with them, and so if you come to the woman who knows everything in the neighborhood, and you tell them about the domestic violence. You tell them about gathering a group of people and giving information, and just you know, presenting the problem. This is what it is. What can you do? How can you help? So throughout the last 2 years, we've been doing that. We've been going to the rural communities, and the promotoras that we have found are people who are bilingual, speak the language of the community, and speak the language of the programs. And not only the specific language, but also serves in a way like a broker. This is the way that I have been explaining it to people, and it's someone who not only is protecting or is advocating for the interest of the community, but also for the interest of the program, and so it's someone in between, balancing out what's the best for both and how to make things work that way, and. We have had so many stories, so many success stories, such as one of the promotoras was helping this victim of domestic violence who went to seek assistance, child care assistance for her son, and she was undocumented. The child was born in the United States, so he deserved he was entitled to the benefit of the child care assistance, and the woman was denied the service, the assistance, because she was undocumented. So this volunteer who was guiding the victim through that process was, she found the information in English and Spanish, and gave the English version to the worker at the child care bureau, and she gave the information in Spanish. Spanish to the victim, and she was like so perfect teaching both of them, and about one about their rights and the other one about their responsibilities, and obviously that she made that whole situation being a successful one, and it worked out. And you may be wondering, how do you even get started? The way that we did get started was by asking simple questions and listening and documenting, and asking questions not only to the community, facilitating a process of dialogue and your conversation, but also to service providers, because oftentimes we, as service providers, think we know everything and we know what's right, and we think feel bad for communities instead of seeing a potential strengths in the community. So we started asking simple, basic questions like, what do you think when you hear someone is a victim of domestic violence or sexual assault, stalking, or teen dating violence? What comes to your mind? And some of the honest questions that came about was, poor lady, or we're here to help, instead of seeing some potential for what strengths, what efforts has she made to survive up to here, and so it's a very, very bottom up approach, and I have to tell you, sometimes it's difficult to implement, because we as professionals, you know, we go to school, we learn a lot to come and solve people's problems. So sitting down and taking a step back and listening and taking what the community and the victims have to say and actually make it into something work, facilitating a process for it to work, it's a difficult task, I have to admit, and I've seen people struggling with that. And so asking the basic questions to community and to service providers brought us to the conclusion that there were different perceptions, that they both had different perceptions. So this approach of utilizing the promotoras has helped resolve some of those misperceptions and teaching both sides and finding like an even ground to work with. Does that tell you a little bit of what it is?
Now, Virginia, so you have how many promotoras are working with you in how many communities again?
It's nine different communities in New Mexico, a total of six paid staff, full-time staff people, five part-time, 55 promotoras trained on the issue and active working from any they do anything from putting up an information fair booth at an information fair, to volunteering to answer the phone in the weekends at the crisis line, or just going to distribute commodities in very rural, isolated areas where the community is like almost trapped between checkpoints of ICE checkpoints. We deal with a lot of immigrants. Farm workers who are in communities where the presence of INS is just something that is huge and prevents them from seeking any services.
Now the 55 promotoras, are they paid as well? Are they volunteer? How does a woman get a hold of them, or do they reach out? Or give me some of the mechanics of that.
All of them are volunteers, but the grant does allow for a stipend to be paid to them. Most of them are receiving a stipend, okay? But we've had some instances where they received a stipend, and then went to cash the check and gave it back to the program because they knew that the program would need would use it more. So it's volunteers who are already doing some work in other aspects, such as there is this promotora in the border area. She's been a promotora for 15 years, and she told me she said in a survey, she got involved because she saw this issue, the issue of educating on domestic violence, sexual assault, as difficult as it was when she was talking about HIV like 12 years ago. She said nobody wanted to hear about it. Nobody, it wasn't their problem. Everyone was like, it's my neighbor's problem. I don't care. I don't want to hear. So she has already developed the trust with the community, and the community knows that whatever issue she's coming to talk to them about, it's important, and it's affecting the community, and it's going to benefit whatever she has to say and she has to share with them is going to benefit them. So that was really an eye-opening for me, because I was like, well, talking about domestic violence is easy. We can all do it. But she was like, no, you don't come to my people and do it this way. It has to be a certain way that you approach them.
Okay. So there are, of these 55 women who are promotoras, they were promotoras, some of them were promotoras before on other topics. They were just women in the community who, let's call them wise women or something, that had
natural
some standing.
Natural leaders. Mm-hmm.
Naturally, they had standing. They were the people that other people went to, or they were respected, huh?
Yes. I'll say about 80%. I don't have the exact number, but about 80% of them were already doing work on the community, and some of them were new. People learned about what we were doing, and they said, I want to contribute, I want to be part of it, and that includes men. And that was also a surprising surprising matter. I did not expect men to, personally, or we people who wrote the grant didn't expect that to happen. But men were very interested when they found out what we were doing. Okay, we're educating the community about the effects of violence against women, and it doesn't only affect women and children; it affects everyone. And so we do have some men almost in every program that have gotten on board.
Very good. Now, you were telling me an interesting story the other day when we had this preparation call about the particular law enforcement agent in one of the areas who works with your promotor and lets her know when it's safe to contact because of ICE.
He's actually a retired police officer. He is a promotor. And
he's a promotor. Okay.
Yes. He works with the program to let them know that when it's he knows everyone in the police department that is around the area, and he knows who would call INS. Which what happens here in some of those communities, the if a police officer does not speak, is not able to communicate with the caller, oftentimes they call an ICE agent to translate, because they would know Spanish and English, and so this promotor is like a key person in that community. He knows when it's safe to call the police without the risk of being deported, and when it's not safe to do that. In that community, we've been learning a lot there, because we started going basing our work on statistics from the police. And the police in some of those communities reported zero incidents, zero calls of domestic violence. And it's like, there is no domestic violence in my community, but what people are saying and what people like this promotor are saying, there is a lot of domestic violence in here, but we're unable to call the police because of so-and-so, these reasons. And so we are now trying to, talk more with the police department and see, this is what domestic violence looks like here, and the fact that people aren't calling doesn't mean there is not, it's not existent. It's just not being, it's not being treated the way it is supposed to, or we should be.
And do the police, are they open to the concept that there's ways to respond to domestic violence without the risk of deportation, or are they pretty much maybe I'm going off on a tangent a little bit here, but are they pretty much wedded to the idea that if they respond, they got to do a check on status, and if so, they got to bring in ICE or whatever?
I think it varies by department. It varies by county, varies by community. Some of them are completely on board with us, the advocates, and learning and trying to, ways to protect victims regardless of their immigration status. And some other communities are very reluctant, and they're, you know, going along with the national trend of being enforcing immigration laws. So it varies.
Do you see a cultural shift in some of these communities then in terms of what they think about domestic violence? You mentioned in the beginning you asked them what they thought about battered women or domestic violence. Is there
absolutely.
Have you seen a shift?
Absolutely. I think during the last meeting that we had to gather feedback from promotoras and volunteers and outreach coordinators and everyone, one of the common theme there was the biggest shift was that the community now understands that programs are not all about separating families, that programs are more comprehensive, and not only shelter is offered to victims of domestic violence, that there is much more than shelter, and there are programs for batterers. And it's a wide variety of services that will ultimately accomplish the goal that the community is seeking, that the violence stops, that the violence does not separate the families. I think someone, either Pat or Leticia, mentioned that women, battered women, want the violence to stop, but they don't necessarily want to leave the person who's abusing them. And so that has been a big eye-opening for everyone, that programs are going to be here to support women, and are going and the programs are learning to what exactly the community needs, and they need a variety of services. They need childcare. They don't only need the shelter. They don't only need the counseling or the protective order. It's what is much more than that.
Oh, great. All right. Thank you, Virginia. Let's open up the lines again just to see if anybody has any questions for you. That was a really good overview. So, operator, if you could open up I guess you don't open up the line, but open up the queue for people to ask questions.
If there are questions on the line, you can press the number 1 on your telephone, and the operator will answer the lines as you come into the question queue. And again, we'd love to hear your questions or comments. While we wait for Stephanie to see who has something to say from the callers on the line, I wondered if I could ask a question, Virginia.
Sure.
So for rural programs across the country who are serving battered women without concentrating on a specific population, so in mm-hmm. your case, you're working, of course, with Latina women, but for non-Native or non-Latina populations that programs might be working with, do you have any kind of crossover recommendations that programs might be able to kind of work through? Like, how would you recommend a program begin to work in similar sorts of ways to what you're doing within their own community, kind of the application of what you're doing in a broader context?
I'm glad you mentioned that, because I do have one of the programs that that does work with it's not a Native community, it's not an immigrant or Latino or Hispanic. It works. The model that we are that we're using, it works because we let them lead. Again, it's the job of the program to find and identify that person who is the everybody goes to. And we have a promotora who is a volunteer at a local hospital, and she everybody in the community goes to her. People seem to just dump the problems on her, like tell her she's finding out so many things that are happening from let's say a teenager who is mentally disabled, she's being abused by someone. She finds out information like that that nobody else would, and she doesn't. And she's the one who is always connecting that person or victims of any type to service providers. So she is a promotora, and she uses that privilege of being trusted by the community to connect the victims with the programs. So it works as long as you let them lead them, and of course just provide support and that make sure that we're complying with confidentiality and the programs you know, rules and things like that. So trying to facilitate the process. It's the process. It's not the ultimate goal. It's the process that makes things work.
So just a question, a follow-up, too. If you have a promotora in a community, I'm assuming that means like a little town or something,
mm-hmm.
or a village. And do the people in the rural area always, who live outside of the town, do they come to this promotora as well? Did you find that their reach moves beyond the boundaries of the community?
It does, yes. Yes,
okay.
We've seen that happen. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So any questions there is in the queue?
At this time, there are no guests in the question queue.
Okay. All right. Well, great. Thank you, Virginia. And again,
sure.
We'll get back to you, too, in the end. And if people think of other questions as you sit with the information, you can jot them down, and there'll be other opportunities to ask questions of Virginia as
sure.
well. Okay, thank you, Virginia.
Thank you.
So now we were going to talk to Pat again, and she was going to highlight specifically a program that they're doing, visiting women in the home in terms of working with their children and the mom. So, Pat, are you there? You want to tell us
sure
a bit about
am.
It? Okay.
I'd like to make a comment on the promotora idea before I get into that.
Okay.
We have several fairly sizable but small communities that are a considerable distance from our primary population center and our office, and I think they might be appropriate to establish something like a promotora
mm-hmm.
in those communities simply because of the traveling distance or the cultural distance between that particular community and where the larger population centers are in our service area. So I can see the possibility.
Oh, yes. You know, I was thinking, too, of a program in the South where the Battered Women's Program went into this rural area and contacted the beauty shop and
mm-hmm.
to see who did women go to.
Mm-hmm.
Who knew
yeah.
other women? Who did they listen to? And, you know, just networking informally like that. And in the case of a couple of communities, it was the beautician, you know. So
mm-hmm.
I think it's a really good model for thinking about the whole grassroots nature. So,
okay. And I forgot, this is Virginia again, I forgot to mention that last month I learned about a study. Sexual assault among Latinas study, where it was found that 63% of victimized women who experienced sexual assault, they went to informal, they sought informal assistance. So I think that is, you know, a way of proving that where people are going to. That,
yes, yes.
So. Go ahead.
Very good. Thank you.
Okay, this is Pat again, and I'll talk about our children's program. Again, it was created at the specific request of the battered women we've been working with, and there was a focus group done before it was organized that created the curriculum, but it didn't identify the biggest challenge, and that was the fact that we are so rural, mm-hmm. and the children's programs we had known about before we started trying our own were all shelter-based. And they worked with the children who happened to be in shelter along with their moms. And we tried to create groupings at schools, and it simply did not work. And so we very quickly had to sit down and look at what was happening and create a different strategy. And what we did was decide to meet with family groups and deal with them in their homes or in their home community, absent the batterer. The batterer had to be gone from the home on a permanent basis in order for it to even happen. And what happens is every advocate makes sure that they share the information with a battered woman so that when she feels she's ready to deal with the many problems that develop with children, just not just the their reactions to what's going on, but their lack of respect, which comes from being manipulated by a batterer to participate in the coercion of their mom. And so we have a room in the office that is a children's room with lots of toys and extra floor space, very small size chairs, and that can be used. A number of women who live relatively close by use that. But in many cases, the advocate goes to the home. If there's a question about safety at all, they can meet elsewhere, and churches are the most common other option. They readily make their rooms available for this. And the way it works, the woman asks for the service. The children's advocate will call her and talk to her about what the program is, and it has a specific curriculum. She'll talk about that. But its underlying goal is to help not only children heal emotionally, but help moms heal emotionally and help reestablish the family structure, which has usually been pretty thoroughly sabotaged. Each visit is about 1 hour. It takes roughly an hour and a half. Based on, she usually brings treats with her. It involves the use of art, storytelling, videos, and a lot of just conversation. The first session is focused on physical violence is not okay. And the second one is on what is a healthy family? How do you want to interact with each other, and what do you do to make that happen? The third one is focused on managing anger. Fourth one is feelings in general, and how do you demonstrate, not just talk respect, but demonstrate respect to each other. And the fifth one is safety planning. That would not be the first time there was safety planning, but that could be the last time the children's advocate and the family meet with her. So they do a particular safety plan at that point. If the mom wants additional sessions and if the advocate can work it into her schedule, because she's in pretty high demand, other sessions could be other forms of abuse, dealing with the whole self-concept, and how do you maintain your own sense of self-worth? How do you support somebody else's? Another topic is loss and grief, because when connections change, there is a sense of loss, and we all go through some kind of grieving around that sense of loss, and how do you cope with that? Another one is problem solving and conflict resolution within the family group. Another one is building a family support system so everybody has safe people to talk to, reliable people to talk to. Another one is trust and respect. Another one is bullying. Another is stranger danger, which gets rarely requested. Assertiveness versus aggressiveness. And then the last one would be choices. Looking at your options regardless of what the problem may be, and how do you generate more options for your situation. The program is funded and has been since its inception by the Community Development Block Grant, and that's been renewed at least four times to my knowledge. And I don't know what's going to happen. I'm concerned that it is vulnerable as we move ahead in the next couple of years with all government funding getting tighter. So we would really have to struggle to figure out what to do if that funding source did change.
Now, Pat, is that a federal money?
Community Development Block Grant, yes. But it's decided at the county level. X amount of dollars are assigned per state based on population, and then the state parcels that out to Community Development Block Grant per county. And then the county locally is the one that decides what they're going to fund. An awful lot of their work is in infrastructure, but about the time we were creating this program, they expanded their guidelines to include some social programming. Now, we happen to be, for you know, lucky with the timing.
So how many women, how many families do you serve in a year? And do you work with the women and the children together or separate or both? Or?
We can work. We have usually been working with the woman individually all along. That's the
Without the children?
Just the general advocacy and court advocacy. And then the woman that we're working with, at the point she decides that she wants the children's program, she would request it. And then we would schedule meeting times with her.
And again, do you meet with her and the children in the
whole
home?
The whole family.
The whole family. Okay, thank you.
Minus the batterer. And we serve, the numbers are usually between 2 and 350 a year. It varies quite a bit.
250 to 350 families?
Yeah, no, children.
Okay, all right, sounds good. And what? Tell us about its success. Or obviously, you're serving many people, so it sounds like there's a lot of requests for it, huh? Do you have waiting lists? Or?
Sometimes we do. We try to keep that to a minimum. But the success is, actually, there's goal setting done with a mom before the advocate goes in. And that's what we use to report to CDBG, the funding source, on the success of the program. The primary goal is to help both the mom and the kids heal emotionally, and that's difficult to measure. That's why at the beginning, before the first session, we'll talk about what the mom wants to achieve and put that in two or three simple statements of what is achievable in a relatively short time span. What we hear consistently is that the ability of the mom to communicate with the kids, the ability of the kids to cope with anger, frustration, if it's at the level of rage, we will often refer to a therapist. Because if it's way out of control, we may not be able to help.
All right.
Okay. So does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you. Now, I was going to, if you have a comment, and then we'll open up the lines again and see if there's any questions for you.
I'm open to any questions.
Okay. Press 1, I guess, is the directions, huh, Liz? And get in the queue, and we'll see if there's anybody who has a question for you.
That's right, and please remember to say your name and where you're calling from. Stephanie, are there any questions on the line?
At this time, there are no callers in the question queue.
All right. Do any of the other speakers have questions of Pat on this particular topic? You must be very succinct, Pat. No questions, huh? Let me ask you, is there anything in particular that is relative to the rural aspect of your program or the rural aspect of the community that you think, first of all, I mean, obviously you decided you needed to go to them because of the transportation issues. Is there anything else that you can think of relative to the rural culture that made this a success, we'll call it a success, or that lent itself to doing this?
Well, I think,
how about that? Go ahead.
I think going to the home or going to the home community is the key thing here. I think having the flexibility for each woman to say what she needs most is also very important. So I think it's more the self-control. Again, going back to what the battered woman wants to focus on first. The first five sessions can be done in any order, and if there is an overriding need to do something else first, that can also be incorporated.
I'm assuming that you're working around women's work schedules as well on this.
Absolutely. So we're talking about a lot of meetings right after school is out, a lot of weekend work at times, although families try to avoid doing this kind of thing on weekends because they want family time too. So most of it is during the day or late afternoon.
Okay. All right. You know, I'm going to ask the same thing of Leticia and Virginia. You know, again, focusing on what is it about rural that makes what you're doing a success, or that you could capitalize. I sound like a corporate leader here, but you know what, that you can capitalize or worked with in order to assure that, first of all, it was something that you could implement and then it had some success to it. Does that make any sense, and can you respond to that? I'll start with Leticia.
Yeah, I think what made it a success for us was meeting clients who have never heard of us and have never worked with us before. That's what made it a success for us, was we were able to outreach to a community that we weren't previously outreaching to and able to provide services to them that they didn't know were available and we didn't know who they were before. So that was big for us when we first started doing this and still continues. You know, we meet clients every day who didn't know who we were, that if it wasn't for this connection, we may have never interacted with them before or helped them stay safe in their relationship.
So that speaks to some of the isolation for the rural woman who doesn't hear about you or know about your services, or...
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, in the community, there's so many different towns and places that I didn't even know existed before we started with this project. And so I think outreach to them, and then, you know, everything is traveling word of mouth in the county. It's about the criminal process, about how we respond to the services. You know, someone calls us to get a resource because their friend told them, you know, we did it for them, which, you know, is definitely a success for our program.
Very good. Virginia, how about you? Do you have a thought about that particular question?
I think so. I think something that is very, very unique about using the promotoras is you don't have to have an advocate, a legal advocate. You don't have to have the staff in your program. When the promotoras are ready doing some of the helping victims fill out, let's say, a restraining order form or something like that. So using the promotoras, the volunteers, the trusted community member, giving them tools and training and recognition and using them to connect with people and potential victims, it's something unique to rural communities. Programs in bigger towns, they have usually staff that, you know, does a specific task, but when you're so rural and you are a 3 or 5 people program, it's really challenging to accomplish everything.
So it kind of helps with the limited staff or limited
yes.
funding for more staff. You know, I was thinking too, as in fact I thought maybe you're going to end your sentence that way, is that I think it is a strength of a rural program that you aren't highly specialized. You know,
right.
I'm thinking about Pat talking about people doubling up and doing things together, and Leticia, you mentioned it as well, that you go in pairs, so there's a So people know each other's work. It's more responding to the particular need as opposed to here's my function, this is what I'll do, I'm the order for protection person, so you come to me, that's what you get, you know.
This is Pat. I think that is a particular feature of the rural culture here. There is an expectation of informality. There is also an expectation that things will be tailored to their situation.
Okay. All right. I like that. There's an expectation of informality. Do you think that there'd be less responsiveness, let's say, if you showed up in your Gucci suit and your leather handbag?
They might not talk to you.
What's that?
They might not talk to you.
So,
yeah, that is a factor.
Okay. So in a way, that kind of it's kind of a check for you too to keep your program more basic.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And that is one of the values that's been consistent throughout the history of the program.
Is that being basic and being like the community as opposed to over-professionalized?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the conversations that regularly takes place in training a new advocate is the concept of professional versus grassroots. And the concept that professional usually implies telling people versus listening.
So, Pat, I was thinking, too, as you were talking about the CDBG grants, the Community Development Block grants, and that they come through the county. That's kind of unique in that the county is coughing up for this particular sort of program. Were there relationships that were built? Did people know people who could make that happen?
Well, it's a history of the program is building strong relationships in the community. And the block grant is only one of the things. We also get funding from the county because of the amount of court advocacy we do. We have negotiated with the county commissioners to share fine money when domestic abuse charges are, when someone is found guilty, a portion of their fine comes to us. The court clerks are supposed to, by law, assist with people in filling out orders for protection, harassment, restraining order documents, etc. They are so severely understaffed, and starting years ago they were struggling. We negotiated with them to reimburse us. We get from a variety of contracts with the county about $50,000 a year out of a $300,000 budget. And, I think that's one that's going to be, we're going to have to protect that in the next several years in particular because the pressure on them financially is getting tighter and tighter. But I think we also have enough of a history, and we have several county commissioners who have specifically taken on keeping us in that budget. It would be hard to reduce that at this point, but you never know.
Very good. So let's open the lines. I see that we're at like 24 minutes after 3. Is there any, if anybody has any questions in the that they want to put into the queue, hit number 1 on your phone, and we'll see if there's any questions, comments. If anybody has an anecdote from your own experience and anything. I'll stop talking and let you have a go at it.
So this is Liz. I have a quick question. I just am wondering about materials that you all might be willing to share. Do you have things that programs interested might be able to read through and somehow customize or replicate in their own communities?
This is Pat. We put together a court advocacy manual about 3 years ago that really spends a lot of time talking about that first conversation with the victim. And I think just that couple of pages might be really useful.
Sure. Okay. Do you have materials, too, about your children's programming, Pat?
Yes, I do. I have the notes that I sent in an email. That's probably the strongest synopsis I have that's not volumes.
Okay.
So, Liz, will you collect these things and then make them available on a website, or what are you thinking?
Sure, yeah. If Virginia and Letitia also have some resources, I'd be happy to compile them and send them out to all of the people that have registered for this session today. So as soon as I have them, I'll send them out. I'll be happy to do so. Does that work for the three of you?
It does. Yes. This is Virginia, and I will send you what I do have, which is how to get started, an application to be for the promotoras, and also a curriculum that we use to train the promotoras on the issue of violence against women. And by the end of March, we will have a model, like a final product, maybe 30 pages or so, on how the model worked, what were the lessons learned, and we'll be sharing it with you all, and maybe you can put it on the website or something. We'll work with you.
Okay, terrific.
Sounds good. Any questions in the queue at this point?
At this time, there are no guests in the question queue.
Oh, very good. Well, that's convenient because we only have a few minutes left. And so any closing comments from either of any of you, Letitia, Virginia, or Pat?
Not really. I want to thank you for the opportunity to be here. But if anything comes up later on, feel free to contact me directly, and we'll be able to figure out the answers to any questions that may come up.
Okay, good. Thank you. Letitia, any closing thoughts?
I don't. I would just echo what Virginia just said. I don't have anything left.
All right, sounds good. Pat?
Oh, I think I've said enough.
Okay. All right. And so I'll just say in closing, I'm very I'm happy to have participated in this call. I think one of the things that it does, even if you don't say, well, we're going to apply that particular thing they did, it seems that in all these cases it was about meeting the needs of the rural clientele. And I think as well that it did, you know, even though you don't hear it necessarily spoken, I think so much of what happens in the very rural areas is that people know people who know people. You see that in the promotorial thing. You see that in the church is willing to get involved. You see that in the way that people are working together and doing this grassroots work. Sometimes we put forth the urban models as being the shining example, and yet you can inadvertently create what I call a metro envy. And so I think it's good to go, okay, well, what is it about our area? Who has power? Who might be a natural leader in this that might be interested? How can we shift some of our budgeting so that we are getting out to them as opposed to expecting them to come to us? How do we need to incorporate attention to safety and those sorts of things? And, you know, I just wanted to highlight just one piece that popped into my mind when Letitia was talking about the Maryland risk assessment piece. Maybe that would be something that, Liz, you could get on as a resource, because I think that that's a really nice method for taking a look at risk, and it's good. It's a good resource for advocacy programs, rural or metro. And so thank you, women, for being on the call, and to all you listeners who joined in. And as you think about what you heard, and as you think about your own community, I think it would be good to keep this going. You know, what is good about rural? We know there's many obstacles, but there's also many, many values and conditions that you can tap into that can create a successful program. So with that, Liz, any final bye-byes that you want to put out there?
No, I just want to take an opportunity to say thank you so very much to Pat and Leticia and Virginia for taking the time and sharing your expertise with us. And, of course, thanks always to you, Rose, for facilitating our call. Of course, thanks to all of you for joining us today. As Rose had said, don't be shy. If you have follow-up questions or concerns you'd like to share with us, feel free to contact me at any point, and I will be happy to direct you appropriately. And as soon as I'm able, I will share the resources forwarded on to me by our speakers today. So watch for that. I will look forward to talking with you again. Thanks so much.